to make smiles, to bring sight to the blind man, and down to the left child, we will survive, in this country wilderness, swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish, jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist, spitting heaven's fire from his lips, burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom." With all that getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the home page, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to OurRadioNetwork.com. Again, that's OurRadioNetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out our Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the B.B. Toomey. Always interesting things being put in the marketplace all the time. Different African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:08 here in the city of Philadelphia on this rainy Sunday evening, and we'll be joined by a special guest after we come from brief commercial break. Author, psychologist, Dr. Jerome Fox will be with us this evening to talk about the book and related subjects, but the book is going to be the central figure around some of the subject matter. His book, Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, A Shame-Based Alliance, will be the center of our conversation this evening, and we'll do that when we talk to Dr. Jerome Fox after we come back from our brief break. And you can always join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies, everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening at 7:14 here in the city of Philadelphia. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard. Brother Richard. Uh-oh, we must have lost Richard here.
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? I can hear you.
I hear you now.
All right.
I hear you now. How you doing?
I'm all right. I guess trying to get connected over here.
Yeah, we hear you coming in loud and clear now. Richard, you know, it's going to be an interesting conversation tonight. But before we get started, how was the events over there at the museum? I know it was some events early in the week.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm really and this is arrogant. I use this term all the time. I'm really arrogant on this point. A lot of the presenters that are presenting, the last one was about Liberia. Before that, it was about Gabriel Prosser. Before that, it was about the Black August. And now that I was caught off guard, the next one for Tuesday is another one around the whole Black August. Will be Tuesday at 10:30 Eastern time. But all these are, the presenters are new people who are newly volunteered to be members of the museum. And they have done an exceptional job in one, using this new medium of Zoom. And some are school teachers and artists and have legal background. And they, you know, wanted to do something that, you know, provide something to the community. And they felt that at the museum, they can utilize their experience. Oh, the other one was about Haiti, excuse me, which was also excellent, the Haitian Revolution. And, you know, provide a service to the community. And I have to give Hannah, who's the director of education, and Samantha, assistant, kudos for, you know, putting this Black August together and making these topics tied to political prisoners, which, you know, and also the history. A lot of these events happened in August as the experience of Africans in the Americas. So, I'm really excited, you know, to answer your question. I was really excited. I'm really impressed. And I'm learning a lot. And guess what, Elliot? Because their programming, they have meditation, you know, like, I mean, it was meditation stopper. They have poetry. And I'm learning that I might be a Negro poet in the hiding, you know? I might got some skills here, you know, because, you know, they do some segments for those, you know, who want to participate. And anybody, just contact the African American Museum in Philadelphia, and you can be able to become a part of the, you know, Zoom class, primarily, you know, this activity. And it's something, and it's poetry. And each time they had a different poet who was providing a different system of how do you develop poetry, which, you know, is all new to me, but it's been a fascinating, you know, moving towards the month.
Yeah. I just want to to check and see how things went. Cause I wasn't able to get over there. Well, they weren't taking people anyway. I wasn't able to participate, so I just wanted to find out how things went.
Good. Oh yeah, and you know, I'm glad. I appreciate that you asked, because I think it's something, you know, especially, you know, people. These are three institutions for now that we can utilize: our cultural institution, our libraries, and our rec centers. And if we can colonize those public institutions, then we can be able to provide programs and even processes like Dr. Fox's, Into Blessedness process of dealing with our addiction to white, because these are public venues that are in communities, in urban communities and rural communities that require public, i.e. therefore our political participation. And then if we take control over them, we can utilize it to reshape or reorientate our value systems so that we become more productive in the environments that we're in.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we're going to talk about with our guest this evening. A radical realignment, so to speak. And I'm just using those terms. I know our guest got the other terms that he's going to use in reference to his book, of our core values. I guess, asserts, and I agree, that one of our major problems is that we are having an addiction to white values, all of us to one degree or another. I totally agree with that. And it always becomes prominent when certain issues come up, because our people are always reacting to things, and have a tendency, some of us have a tendency not to plan. This political environment now, and these new announcements that came over the past week, and the responses from some of our people, kind of leaves me scratching my head. Mm-hmm. I want to bring our guest in to talk about some of these things in relation to his book. And our guest tonight is author and psychologist Dr. Jerome Fox. The book, Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, A Shame-Based Alliance. Dr. Fox, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening. Thank you for having me.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine.
How you doing now?
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Fox, I know you heard me and Richard talking before you came on with us. I want you to kind of put a little clarity from your expertise on the mental state of some of our people. Some realize it. I believe most don't. To talk about that addiction to white. I want to kind of set the environment by a quote that you made in your book. And I'm going to read that quote to you. You quoted Emil Cockerbrawl that he states that true liberation for black people could not be achieved without a cultural revolution ending with the re-Africanization of their souls. When an African's spirit self is wounded, bound, or estranged, life becomes rudderless, incomprehensible, and dependent. Dr. Fox, talk about that from your perspective and our behaviors presently.
Right. Well, prior to that statement, I think that's in chapter 2 that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. In the very first chapter, very frankly, I guess I could say state or assert really that we as black people are addicted to an oppressive white value system, really value system disorder, which has frustrated our natural quest for life, liberty, and blessedness. Notice I did not say happiness. A grave obstacle to our well-being as a black people collectively lies in our ideological entanglement with a white social order that is predicated on narcissism, greed, and unjustifiable violence, which prevents us from really doing all that we could do, perhaps even by this time should have done, to liberate ourselves permanently. We seem to take, you know, perhaps a step or two forward sociopolitically, and then maybe a step or two backward, depending on who's in the White House or who's in positions of authority. Notice I did not say power, because power is not interpersonal. It's intrapsychic. I perhaps can say more about that later, but authority is interpersonal, and it's granted by the state or by the government under which you live. So, you know, we take through their authority over our existence, they can push us back, you know, a step or two, even when we think we've made some progress in their context of what I call their context of hate, in which we have been forced to try to survive within that context of hate. It hasn't worked, and it will never work until we, as I say even earlier in the book, let me see if I can turn to that, I think in the preface, that we black people must focus on freeing ourselves from white supremacy in all its disguises. And believe me, it has many disguises. And the more subtle ones are in our head. But we as a black people must focus on freeing ourselves from white supremacy in all its disguises, or remain in great peril while relying on those who hate us to provide the basic necessities of life, which include sustenance, that's our food, clothing, shelter, energy, safety, health care, and knowledge. And we see over and over again that we experience really over and over again their betrayal. We like children and have allowed ourselves to become dependent upon them for everything, including every thought that that we produce out of our brain. We don't have an independent thought, quite frankly, and I can prove that very easily. So we've allowed ourselves to become very dependent upon them, and each and every time they betray us. We see what have been doing, what's happening really right now with this COVID, because we have not established a consciousness that would never allow us to be wholly dependent upon them. We have failed to build our own institutions like hospitals and healthcare. Now, we did it at a certain point, but because of our mind conditioning, our brainwash, we thought our own institutions were not good enough. So we let them go in favor of becoming more and more dependent upon white folk, what we call integration. It's nothing but a form of very treacherous and perilous dependence upon a people who demonstrate over and over again that they do not have our best interest at heart. So we see once again what happened with this COVID thing. We can't get tested. We can't get supplies, et cetera. We can't get the proper type of response from that, from their healthcare system, because it is their healthcare system as opposed to being ours. There's a lady here, and I can't think of her name, a doctor, a sister doctor here in Philadelphia, who stepped out on her own,
Sanford,
to form an alliance among black doctors,
mm-hmm.
and to try to, mobile approach to going from one black neighborhood to another here in Philadelphia to try to test our people. If we had had our own hospital, she wouldn't have had to do all that. We would have been better prepared for something like this. But basically, that's the dilemma that we find ourselves in. And by the way, it's fine. All that I just said is a description of the problem. Our addiction and that addiction being forcing us to have a level of dependence upon our enemy that we should not have. All of that is a description of the problem. What I feel is the real problem facing, or at least the first problem facing black people all over the world. But we have to get to the point where we are more interested in solving the problems that we face. And currently we're not. I think for a variety of reasons, we've also allowed ourselves to be more comfortable in their context of hate. And if you're comfortable, you're certainly not motivated to disrupt any, to disrupt the apple cart, so to speak. We just have enough of a wedge of an apple, sort of a so-called piece of their poisonous pie, to placate us and satisfy us. So there's not really the motivation there to move toward solving the problem. We do a lot of saber rattling, a lot of, you know, boasting and, just fake talk about what we should do or perhaps what we could do. But there's not a lot of movement, not enough movement toward actually really solving our dependence upon white supremacists permanently.
Dr. Fox, the problems I want to focus in on a couple tonight to kind of highlight the conversation, but I want to go back to, I think it was in the first chapter of the book where you talk about problem solving, and I'm going to preface this by, and ask you a question. And you cite 4 points here: describe the problem, generate possible solutions, test one possible solution, and then evaluate the outcomes, and if not satisfied, repeat any or all the steps until satisfied.
Right. That's now, the preface.
Now, okay. Now, when you're talking about any problems that we face, some of our people have a tendency, and sometimes it has legs where it takes a popular type of mindset to believe that we can't solve our problems without Europeans being involved. No other people have that mindset when it comes to internal problems or problems that they have that they need other people involved. Does this go to what you're talking about the addiction to white? And if so, explain.
Well, exactly. And I would like to sort of rephrase.
Go ahead.
The description of the problem, because also, as I indicate in the preface, sometimes we don't get to an effective solution to the problem because we have described the problem wrong. So we describe a problem and perhaps set out to solve it, but we find out that even if we think we solved the problem that we just described, we're still not free or we're still not happy. Well, that's because you solved the wrong problem. So how you conceptualize the problem is extremely important. So I just want to change a slight word or two and how you describe the problem. The problem is that we have been conditioned I forget what we have been conditioned to believe that we cannot independently solve our own problems without the help of our enemy. Now, right there from the way that I describe it, it kind of shines a light on what perhaps the solution might be. Number one, I said that we were conditioned. By using that term, I'm inserting hope for our recovery as opposed to you are just this way. Well, if you're just this way in a static sense, but then maybe there's no hope for you to change your behavior or alter your behavior. But if I say you have been conditioned, in other words, you learn, and you have perhaps even been forced to learn a particular behavior or even accept a particular idea, then that offers some hope, because anything that can be learned, anything that has been learned, rather, can be unlearned. And then when I say that we're dependent upon our enemy, automatically that shines a light on what we really do face, that in a sense we have not put ourselves in this condition ourselves, or rather we're not in this condition or in this predicament because of what we did to ourselves. Something has been done to us, and we need to recognize that and then move forward to find out, can we undo by ourselves what has been done to us? And as it turns out, we certainly can, without any help. As a matter of fact, we really don't need or really shouldn't be seeking any help for this particular task, which is to detoxify our souls, ourselves, our brains, our behaviors from this white value system. Disorder, this white value system disorder. We're trying to once again find our place in their context of hate, and that will never work. What we need to be doing is forming our own context of love. The context of hate, the ultimate goal for their context of hate is always murder, ending in death. So it's all you trying to survive in that context and accepting the principles upon which that context rests, you'll always be about murder, murdering yourself in this case. That's why we have so much gang banging, so much even our diet. Everything we do leads to our death. That's what happens when you're accommodating a context of hate. In contrast, a context of love, the ultimate goal of the context of love is life, and life more abundantly. We have to make a choice. In which room or context do we want to set up our existence and move forward with? Obviously, in the context of hate, we're not going to make very much progress. So if we start with the idea that we've been forced to learn something and then conclude that therefore we can unlearn it, that gives us also some compassion for each other. When I first started trying to promote this book, the typical response to this idea of addicted to, right, most people just love the title, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor. But the typical response, and it's a pride response, by the way, a false pride response, is that, yeah, they sure are, meaning other black people, not me, but they, them, those Negroes over there, certainly are addicted to white. If you start out with that attitude, you'll never be able to convince our people, all of whom, including oneself, who are indeed addicted to white. Already, you're practicing value of number five. I enumerate in the workbook, and it is a workbook, by the way. Most of the book is dedicated to describing the protocol for detoxification. But at any rate, in the workbook, I'm forgetting my train there, what I was saying.
You mentioned about a lot of some of our people subscribing to value number five.
Right.
Yes.
Value number five, which I describe in the workbook, definitely states that the owner, perhaps I should turn to that so I don't misquote myself, is that the only way, as I try to get it, the only way that we can, we have been conditioned, once again, to believe that the best way, at least, to feel good about ourselves is by surpassing, outdoing, and defeating someone else in an activity, achievement, or personal characteristic. In other words, putting competition over cooperation and constantly in search of ways that we can distinguish ourselves from each other as opposed to cooperating with each other. And by the way, our liberation depends on our ability to cooperate and unite with one another. But because we are suffering from this condition of being addicted to white values, as soon as even so-called woke folk hear the title, they don't realize this. Their instincts have been conditioned to say, not me, because I'm on a perpetual search to distinguish myself, from other black people, so I can, because I've been told that's the only way I can feel good about myself. And that's why I gossip and are constantly in search of some way that I can, once again, prop myself up by standing on the carcass of a defeated brother or sister. So I love putting other black people down. So, yeah, that's where that comes from. But I don't know if I know we started out with you stating really talking about the problem, the description of the problem. But hopefully, if we can approach each other properly with compassion, we might be able to convince and persuade, because it is a matter of persuasion, each other that perhaps we have a problem, number one, and that we together, as I say at the end of the book, really can solve the problem. And in fact, we together is the only way this addiction will be solved.
We're in conversation this evening with author and psychologist Dr. Jerome Fox. The book, Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, A Shame-Based Alliance. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. And we'll probably start taking some questions and all in the second hour of the program. Brother Richard, jump in here.
Yeah, you know, in preparing for our dialogue tonight, I was looking at something, but I'm in hearing, you know, in the discussion so far, one thing that came to mind that Dr. Fox said, and is that there, it seems to be the end goal is to have intrapsychic, I'm gonna call it healing, and i.e. power from that healing, which and the other thing that came to mind, you know, because this is the you know, where you started, Elliot, around this whole thing about the political environment that we're in right now, mm-hmm. and the discussions that are happening in relationship to the candidates. And, you know, one thing that I've been saying, Dr. Fox, is that that what you raised about the corona, you know, virus, and really the what it has showed about African people's public health, there are what they call it, morbidities.
Health morbidity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our health morbidities, that we're in a public health crisis.
Yeah, and we've been in that crisis for a while.
Mm-hmm. Right, and when I looked in your book, and I wanted to want you to starting from here for me in the questioning, and it'll be like three parts to this one part, and I have just two, but you in the section around mental health, you say, perhaps the greatest obstacles to Africans in even forming positive groups, not to mention actually accomplishing something, is the mental status of each potential group member. And then you go on to say, to develop and maintain mental health, a person must have the support of a healthy environment that includes other mentally stable people. And because public health is a political political, and that's what I'm trying to tie the two together. Would you agree that demands that we have exert some type of political control over the public health apparatus to deal with our mental health?
Right. Well, I guess from my from the book's perspective, I'm trying to empower us to assume greater agency in our lives, meaning that there's a lot of things we can do sort of informally, but certainly together to help us overcome this addiction to white folk, that because we're in such a precarious state of mind that we're not going to have the overly sort of formal organizations that would be nice if we had. And the formal systems, be they healthcare or education or some other system, it's almost as if we're starting out afresh. It's like the reconstruction period that we're starting out afresh and trying to cobble together whatever resources we have right now to begin the process of this mental healing. And I'm saying that we can't depend on the mental health system, their mental health system, to do the job that we must do, just as we can't depend on their educational system to do the job that we must do in terms of educating our children. So we have to ask ourselves, what can we do? And we can certainly, that's why I came up with this whole idea of this Into Blessedness groups that are kind of patterned after the AA tradition, which has began with, you know, two people who pretty much, although they were white, they found themselves as alcoholics in a similar predicament that we're in. It's like the healthcare system at that time was not addressing addiction. And, at their time, those two people who found it, if you had an alcoholic problem, you were considered to be morally defective, much like we're considered to be defective. So there was no effort in even their own system to address that type of problem. So what did they have to do? They decided, well, hey, look, we have some agency ourselves, so let's just come together and form a group, realizing something that I say, I believe it's maybe the last chapter in the book, where I say, for a solution to white value dependency, Africans or black people must gather together, grounded in the self-help philosophy that nothing so much ensures immunity from active addiction as intensive work with fellow recovering addicts. So in a sense, it's very informally, we can take this bull by the horn and solve it ourselves without an elaborate, without having the aid of an elaborate healthcare system or mental healthcare system to aid us in this process. It's almost like, because this just came to mind, Booker T. Washington's the phrase, throw your bucket down where you're at, meaning don't be, you know, concerned about what you don't have and what they haven't done, this, that, and the other. You have a bucket in your hand, throw that down where you're at and start digging.
And the reason I'm raising this, because in the exchange that you and you just had with Elliot, one thing, and Elliot giving the process of problem resolution, of what you need to go through problem resolution, which means that we have to define what the problem is exactly, right?
That's right. Well, that's what I say in the preface, that you can, if you don't do that, if you don't really use your brain to really think it through, you'll wind up solving a problem or the wrong problem, or certainly a problem that will not lead to your objective, your ultimate objective. And if that is, you know, permanent liberation, you better make certain that whatever is blocking that from happening, that you recognize that thing as the problem and not something else.
And that's why I wanted to start with, you know, the quotes you had in relationship to mental health, because it seems, based off of what you're saying, we have a mental health, being addicted to these values, we have a mental health challenge as a people.
Right. And I would even say, let me just insert this. I would even go a little bit further and say that all problems that we think we see and are able to describe, all of our problems, all roads lead back to our brain, our thoughts, and our emotions. Those same ideas in our brain and emotions that they generate, that have been constrained or in some way controlled by our adversaries, leading to this addiction and the dependency upon them, that is the result of our addiction. All roads, so I don't care where you start, be it Mr. Floyd, the late Mr. Floyd, and other, all the other unjust assassinations of our people by officially sanctioned assassins that we call police persons. All of that really leads back to our mind. And if we don't stop and address that, we're not going to make very much progress and securing ourselves and our future permanently.
And that leads me, and staying in the context, and I think you're agreeing with me that we have to stay, and staying in the context of the mind, we have to stay in the context of, you know, that we're addressing our mental health, and because of our particular, and I think our experience as a people is particular. And I was looking at it someplace else where in this book, where we keep us safe, and I wanted to see how with and staying in that context of mental health. He says that the Zach Norris says that the behaviors of traumatized people are not the result of moral failings or signs of lack of willpower or bad character. They are caused by actual changes in the brain. So I'm trying to raise in the addiction to white and our association to white values. Do we have to also acknowledge that this trauma of the transatlantic slave experience has had a significant impact? And one of the impacts, the mental health impact, deals with the question about fear. Have you addressed that in your book, or is that something that we should be looking at as we're dealing with the solution of dealing with our inner psychic health?
Well, are you saying that should we be looking at the issue of fear?
And trauma.
Right, fear and trauma. Yeah, and I have a whole section on fear. And I do also talk about the whole section on fear. I believe it's 113. Let me turn to page 113 right now. And how it controls our every. Yeah, it's on page one, starting on page 112. And I talk about, and I guess the next to the last chapter, I think it's chapter six, I'll talk a little bit about the epigenetic lingering effects, intergenerational effects of the trauma that we've been through, and even recommend a particular article on a trauma informed curriculum for children in their schools, and how we can take that. It was developed by Crackers, but we can take some of those principles and apply it to our people as a whole, not just students, but to our people as a whole. But one thing that you did say that is a little bit more difficult to address is the changes that occur in the brain, and obviously also in our genes. And in fact, what you had read is exactly the conclusion that those two white men who developed AA had also concluded, that there were some neurological changes that had occurred in their brain, given their long-term dependence upon alcohol. And there had to be a system that accommodated those neurological changes as they were trying to help people enter and maintain recovery. And the whole idea of being very patient, and in some instances almost like surrounding the person with 24-hour support, is a way of overcoming the neurological impulse to relapse. And at a certain point, we may have to do that too, in order to. That's why I recommend the group, because the group is more helpful in applying the support that we need in order to overcome the sort of biological or chemical impediments to change. A show that I don't know how many people in your audience may have viewed from one time or another. It's called, it's on OWN. It's called Iyanla Fix My Life. And if you look at the way that she deals with those people who are in complete trauma, there's two families that that she has dealt with that really break your heart. The parents were addicted, and really the children wound up in foster care and all kinds of abuse and stuff. I mean, it just makes you want to cry. But if you look at how she deals with the guilty parent who sort of dropped the baby and really dropped them, both figuratively and literally, how she helps that parent deal with their guilt is the same way in which a combination of toughness and also understanding, compassionate understanding, insistence upon accountability, but at the same time understanding their limitations as they grow and mature into becoming more accountable adults. So there are techniques for overcoming some of those more obstinate obstacles, like the changes that have occurred in your brain over these centuries of being forced. That's the trauma of being forced to psychologically enslave your brain to these people.
And Elliot, do I have okay?
Go ahead, Richard.
Do I have another? Because I want to pursue just the one value and follow up.
Go ahead.
And to do this, to set this up, I wanted to go to Baba West. Wrote a book, Our Story, the original Holocaust, and Dr. Fox. It's and without the value that I want to. I'm looking at is the value number four, which is individual versus collective, that you know, individualism better than collectivism. In his book, he said, I'm going to use this to set this up and then to go to your text in order to get your feedback about it. He said, instead of using the models of Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, members, not all, but a majority could not embrace the philosophy and opinions of Mr. Garvey. One of the main reasons happens to be New Orleans is the sister capital of gay rights. Because the new millennial of 2000 has been designated as the time for the arrival of the cross-dresser and sexually deprived, Blacks in New Orleans are leading the way in making same-sex relationship honest, legal, and above board. And I wanted to use that because of the political context that we're talking about, especially as we move to this presidential election and the interest groups that they're addressing, Black women, other ethnic minorities, and the LGBTQ community. And in value four, you say one of the challenges, you say individualism individualism better than collectivism. That's a white value that we have. And I'm asking myself and I'm posing to you based off of looking in your book, is this individualism such an American value? Now, on page 75 of your book, you say the value is one of the white oppressor's main effective weapons against the oppressed. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming you're saying individualism. And then you go on to say, for Africans who are blind to the fact that there is no lasting security in rugged individualism, the setting aside of group needs to pursue personal gains is all too easy. And the reason why I'm raising that Baba West was raising in relationship to his experience in New Orleans is that there's so much discussion about voting one, right? And it seems that for us, it comes out not as a collective decision, but that we individually has to go for a particular candidate or party. And the other manifestation of this individualism that is so integral a part of the society, which I'm looking for your feedback to confirm, is that the LGBTQ community is saying people have the individual right to self-identify. Now, doesn't that go against us looking at being a collective if the society is saying we should be viewing things so adamantly from an individual perspective, which you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying is not a healthy perspective to be as African people to be moving from.
Right. Now, I get this question in various forms a lot. And I have addressed this, this individualism and various points, but the point that you just raised, I think I best address it on my page 126 when I talk about unity and organization as a weapon that we must use more effectively. It seemed like you said a lot there, because it seemed like you started out pretty much saying what I've heard many times before. Dr. Fossey, what you're saying sounds more like just human frailty as opposed to, you know, white folk or being addicted to white. It seems as if you were saying is this emphasis on the individual, more of just human nature. And my response to that is that even if it is, I'd say that this system, this white value system disorder, for instance, is predicated on narcissism, greed, and violence. And people will say, but wait a minute, isn't everybody that way? That's not just that. That's not white. That's human. But I say that what has made it more of a problem than perhaps what it ought to be is the fact that whites have developed a social system that elevates the baser, seedier aspects of our nature, as opposed to what I would call true civilization, which simply is the organization of a culture with its laws and its practices to limit the expression of our baser instincts. So that's where it becomes really very political and just beyond the human tendencies that we may all have. We have to decide as a people what it suits us best in terms of freeing ourselves from this mental and economic and educational oppression that we are currently in. So that's one thing. As I said, what was kind of like your second issue that, by the way, let me say this too, that I say in terms of our ability to unify as opposed to be ruggedly individual, I give the example, I won't go through read it all here, but then I give the example of us looking at white folk basically and wanting what they want. what they have, rather, and feeling ashamed. This is why we have the one of the ways is that this shame-based analysis or alliance rather works. That I make you envious of what I have, and then deny you from getting it, and tell you that the reason that you don't have it is because of some defect in yourself, and so you become ashamed. And you are set on a course of really, number one, worshiping me because I have all the goodies, and then also trying to be just like me, thinking that somehow you can throw all of the defects that I have convinced you that you have just simply by copying me, and if not in color, certainly in ideology, and an exact replica of myself. But as I mentioned in this section, that may work for people whose needs are already being addressed by the government that they have set in place, and when those needs are not or come under threat. We see what they do. They gather an army, and they go to war. But before they actually debouch onto the battlefield, they gather their soldiers, the sort of requisite mass of people that I talk about often and that we need in order to fight our fight. They gather a requisite mass of people so that they call soldiers, and send those soldiers first and foremost to boot camp, whereby all of this rugged individualism is washed out of them, and they become a unit, a team, and it's all for one and one for all, and that whole boot camp experience is nothing but a process of indoctrination. Some would say good indoctrination, because you're preparing a group of people to defend all that you have established, you know, i.e. your nation. So our enemy realizes that there is a time for all of their talk about individualism and the merits or the benefits, not even the merits, but the benefits of individualism. Somehow they know when to come together and put all that individualism crap aside in order to defend their turf. But they've convinced us that we don't even have anything worth defending to the point where we would reject that value, that white value, long enough to kind of put ourselves in our own boot camp, which I refer to, which I believe this whole Into Blessedness procedure that I designed is a form of boot camp in order to unify our brains, unify ourselves, and come out fighting as on one team.
We're going to take about 10 minutes, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we got some calls on the line, and since some other callers can get involved and ask questions. We're in conversation with author and psychologist Dr. Jerome Fox. The conversation is centered around his book, Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, A Shame-Based Alliance. And again, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832, and we're going to take a brief break in about 10 minutes. Before we do that, Dr. Vox, let me throw some examples out there before we go to the break and get you to give an analysis of some of these behaviors, because what you're saying here, that a lot of these things are behaviors, some conscious and a lot unconscious. That's what I believe. A lot of it is unconscious. And if you're talking about an addiction, And I thank the Almighty that I've never been addicted to any type of substances. But when you're talking about an addiction and you're trying to recover, then you have to start eliminating things from your life and distancing yourself from certain things that will cause you problems.
Yes.
Now,
that's called stimulus control.
Okay. Now, when we're talking about us trying to renew the minds of our people in a lot of different things, whether you're talking about education, politics, economics, even religion, it's certain things that we have to cast off, and ideals and values. And usually you have leadership that assists people in doing that. If you're talking about other forms of government or other nationalities, our people are different because generally your leadership is not assisting our people in breaking that addiction to white. It's
Now,
I'm gonna give you a couple of examples, and I'll give you because I want to go to break and then get the other people involved. Uh-huh. Let me give some examples.
Can I just say this?
Go ahead.
Insert this real quick.
Go ahead.
That the reason why we don't have our politicians doing that is because they neither they nor we really see ourselves as having a problem with being addicted to white values.
Okay.
Until we are able to see that problem, we will never solve it. But go ahead.
Now, let me give a couple of examples. And me, just a layman, the way I see some addictions to white. And these are just political examples. Mm-hmm. I got one here. We accept other values before our own politically. When you see politicians out there lying at the drop of a hat and things of that nature, our people, just for the sake of having leadership, have a tendency to overlook it and accept it.
Right.
Number two, I got when we they say anything to us, and some of our people have a tendency to believe it, especially when it's coming from white politicians. They can say, well, I want to help black folks. I'm going to do this. And our people have a tendency to believe it because it's coming from a white mouth. Number three, I wrote down, our people have a tendency to take pride when it's the first. This is the first person to do this. This is the first vice president that's black. It's the first black president. That idea of being the first because it's a white society, to me, that shows an addiction to white. But I want to get you to talk about it in a little more in depth when I finish this.
I will,
this,
yeah. We talked about that, yes.
This last
I'll go into depth.
Good. This last example I got. When we give excuse when black people, especially politicians, don't speak to our issues specifically and promote acceptance to white domination, saying that, I can't help black people. I got to help all people.
Excuse their betrayal.
Okay. Yes. Go ahead. Before we go to a break, give a little brief synopsis of that and how those behaviors are white addictions.
Well, I'll probably have to go into it more in more depth after we come back from the break. But I figured we would get into this at some point during our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, here again, we have been conditioned. These behaviors, they may seem to be unconscious, but what they really are behaviors that have gained what we call in school psychology automaticity, meaning that they are automatic behaviors that we no longer have to think about. So we have been conditioned and have developed these automatic responses to believe through this white addiction that white folk are legitimate arbiters of what should be in life, in a sense, is to be as generic as possible, and therefore are our judges. They because white folk work worship money, and we worship white folk, and so we have been set on a course of trying to prove to white people that we are worthy of their approval. And I'll stop there and break it down later. And all of these behaviors, these political behaviors that you just listed, begin with that false premise that we have something to prove to white people, when in truth, given, as I say later on in the book, given their calamitous behavior in this world, it is not we who have anything to prove to them. It is them that have everything to prove to us, and especially to prove to us and the world that that they are able to peacefully coexist with other people who don't look like them and perhaps don't think like them. That's what they have to prove. But unfortunately, we have been duped into thinking that we have something to prove to them. And all of these political behaviors issue from or emanate from that false premise. And I can talk about that later.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can get involved in the conversation. I see some callers up here now. You can do that by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with author, psychologist, Dr. Jerome Fox, the book Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, A Shame-Based Alliance. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I say that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds and wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He'll still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:28 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation tonight with author, psychologist, Dr. Jerome Fox. The book, Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, A Shame-Based Alliance. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Let's go straight to the phones. Let's go to 404. You first up.
Hey, peace and blessings, Yehudu, Brother Elliot, and Richard, and Dr. Fox. Y'all hear me? How y'all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good. How you doing now?
Hey, I'm still learning, man. I know you, Dr. Fox, man. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I heard you so many times on Car Show, man.
Thank you.
So much stuff. And I like what you're doing, man. You're trying to throw our mind out. See, we hooked on this ice. Them folks is ice people, man. And I'm trying to, when I describe the internet, I know with Elliot, I got to make sure I censor myself. Don't use too many superlatives. Excellent. Well, that's a little off comedy. But Dr. Fox, man, I love the way you come out. You're describing it. Because it's all about this paradigm shift and mind thing. Okay? And some of our people, they're going to be stuck, man. Like the ones that is into this swirl stuff that's laying down with these animals, man. I can't fathom that, man. But they still, after all the stuff that we went through with them, they want to lay down and marry them and make babies, and then half of them, they end up missing. The enemy end up taking them out. They get chopped up somewhere, missing. But them the ones that, hey, they threw, man.
But can I say this? Can I insert this? That
yes, sir.
Yeah, we face a lot of problems as a people, and all of those problems lead right back to our mind. But I do caution people, just as you have, that, well, I ask, in what war has there been no casualties? And certainly the war that we've been in for over 400 years has been a psychological war. And there have been and there will continue to be casualties. So the people that you mentioned, I just say with sadness in my heart, they are just the casualties of war. You're right. Some of us will never be convinced that the white that their white God is a fake, and that it's fruitless rather to worship them. But those who cannot be convinced are just simply the casualties of this war. And I say respectfully, you know, that I'm sorry that they lost their life. And when I say lose their life, I mean their mental life, their mind, in the war. But we have to expect that there will be some. And we can't spend a lot of time giggling and really thinking about that and putting those people down. I know they're like the walking dead, so you still see them. We can't bury them underground. But at some point, we just have to be about our business and still trying to gather those who may look dead, but hopefully can come alive when they hear the right word. That's just how I see it, that I don't allow the walking dead who will remain dead I occupy too much of my time or my thought. I'm looking for those who are sick but can be healed.
Brother Wes,
the more you talk about collateral damage. Hold on, Elliot. I got some more questions, man.
Go ahead.
That's collateral damage. That's collateral damage. Okay, you're right. You got to don't worry about them. Just try to wake them up. They don't wake up. Leave them sleep. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fox, man, it's so much of my brain trying to click in for Elliot hang up on me, but check my problems is, I'm going to say this about the problem, then I come up with a solution. One of our problems is, like, we talk too much, man. Imagine if we tell the enemy all our secrets, man.
By the way, I have a chapter on that, or a section on that in the book. It's one of the weapons that we need to learn how to perfect. And the weapon is called silence. Keep your mouth shut. And I say, loose lips sink ships. And we have to learn that.
That's so, because the priest don't get caught until you open his mouth, man. That's the southern thing for y'all down south. That's the only way a priest get caught, when they open his mouth. And so you imagine that all the stuff that we learn and show, all the enemy do is take what we tell them and use it against us anyway. Okay, so we got to learn that, man. And so I'm gonna close on this point right here before Elliot moves the next caller. I like what you said, man, on Carl's show, about we need to have our own reciprocity team that they got the invisible night of they of what they got. So we got to come up with our invisible night and start really giving them reciprocity. Because I don't want no just ice, man. That's what these niggas just talking about. No just ice, no peace. See, you got to learn the words, man. So, hey, Dr. Fox, hey, man, get my number. So when you get ready to do what you're going to do, I reciprocity team, you know what I'm talking about, right? I got $100 donation for you, man. So we got to do this, man. That's the only reason why I joined, man. You know what I'm talking about, right, Dr. Fox?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Okay, man, I've been ready for this, man. That's what I wait for people to catch up, man. We got to go ahead and dispense and do what the universe do, man. To start giving them some reciprocity. Okay, I know LM know what I'm talking about too, man. You know, that's why I learned how to use the words and talk about what we talk about. Then we go silent on them and do what we got to do. You know what I'm talking about, Dr. Pop?
Of course.
Okay, man, I love you, man, because that's the only way to do it, man. Because, see, I'm one more thing. On this covert virus, see, I study what I do. I studied what has happened the past, not to get stuck on it like a lot of us stuck on the past, and then that'll tell me what they're going to do in the future. That's their algorithm, right? I.e., this covert virus, I love it, man, because it's shutting everything down. That's a good thing for us. And so what they did in the 60s, they came up with this live out the polio virus, right? And so all they do is put that fear in on us. See, first we start talking about, black people don't get it. We don't get that. And so the enemy heard us. And so what they do, they start cooking the book to the numbers, talking about we the number one group that's getting this monkey virus. So what they're going to do is say we the number one group that's getting it. They're going to try to make us go and take this shot involuntarily, because you know our people believe everything they see on television. And so it's imperative that we not take this shot, man. It's imperative, man, because I'm a living witness. I took that polio vaccine back in the day, me and my cousin, and both of us end up with kidney cancer. And then I talked to a white boy that took the vaccine, supposedly what I took, he didn't have no problem. And so what my deductive reasoning is, they got two batches of vaccines, one for us to knock us off, and then one for them, no problem, see? We at war, man. So that's why I study their algorithm. So I know what they're going to do because I study their history. I don't get stuck on it. So that keeps my defenses up, man. Okay, I study out of Walt, and I love y'all, Elliot, and long-winded Richard. But I love y'all, man, and I appreciate it, man. So Dr. Fox, I love you, man.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Yeah. Let's go to 267-902.
Hey, good evening, Elliot. Good evening, Richard. And I'd like to say good evening to Dr. Fox. How are all you guys doing?
How you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, Dr. Fox, I bought your book when I first heard you announce it on 1450 AM. It's been a while. I haven't picked it up in a while, but I realize in your book, you base your book on the recovery aspect. And knowing a little, knowing some things about recovery and the steps, the individual himself has to actually want the help. And if they don't want it, they're not going to receive it. And I don't care if you show them all the evidence around them that they're wrong through their arrogance, rebellion, and apathy. That's just going to drive them deeper into that cesspool. And that come, and you know, I heard Elliot talk about substance, but one thing about addiction is it's mental, physical, and spiritual. So, you know, that person themselves has to recognize their need for help. Other than that, and that's our major problem. We have people who know there's a problem, they just don't see it in themselves. So what they do, through their arrogance, through their apathy, they're just going to continue doing what they're doing, and I can't blame you. You don't waste any breath on those people that don't want it. Now, the Honorable Marcus Garvey, and I hear people quoting him all the time on Time for Awakening. He said it way back there in the 40s. He said, it's not my intention to take all Negroes back to Africa. There are some that are no good here, and there'll be no good over there. Until we get that mindset and realize that some of our people don't care, don't want to, because what I'm seeing now, you got a group of arrogant, nasty, self-centered, stubborn people that want to strong arm you and tell you, if you don't vote for this white man that said if you don't vote for him, you ain't black, then, you know, they don't want nothing to do with you. And you know what? They do me a favor when they say that, because I don't want nothing to do with them. You know? So I'm just saying, this thing, addiction is in degrees. And the person that's addicted to certain things don't even realize. Some of them realize it, and they're trying to get help. Those are the ones you can reach out and help them. But the ones that don't want it, that are proud and stupid with their arrogance, their apathy and self-centeredness and stubbornness, gotta lead them where they at, man. And so, you know, and that's coming from a recovery aspect, because that's what your book is based on. And there, and you know, and I'm gonna say one more thing too. And you know, I you know, to some people, what I'm saying might be cool, but like Wes was saying, it's cannon fodder. You, like you said, you have a part in your book on silence. There's a scripture in the Bible, in the book of Proverbs. It even says, and this is for all these people who like to run their mouth and tell you who they are or whatever. There's a scripture in the Bible say, even a fool, when he keeps his mouth shut, is deemed wise. So, you know, a lot of our people just want to rattle their mouth and talk, and you don't see nothing of substance that come out of it. So I just wanted to say, like, you know, what do you think about everything I just said to you?
Well, the one thing that I wanted to zoom in on is this frustration that I hear in your voice. And sometimes that frustration can get in the way of us doing what we could do to help each other. It is true, as I just said, there has been no war in which there have not been casualties. And some of these people who cannot be persuaded are the casualties of this psychological war that we've been fighting for over 400 years now. But I'm not one to just throw up my hands and say that, you know, there's nothing that can be done, because I know from my own personal process of detoxification, as well as people that I know, that some of the people who seem hopeless and helpless turn out not to be so, when they are approached in the right manner. And you wind up gathering far more people for the work at hand than what we would have ordinarily thought that we could have gathered. There is such a technique called motivational interviewing. And with that tool in hand, you can talk to people in a way that motivates them to seek what they ordinarily would not be interested in. Just through pointing out what they are dissatisfied with in their life. You can ask a person who seems to be deep in the throes of their addiction, but they still recognize the damage that addiction is doing to their life. Just as we recognize when we see videos of the murderers of our people under the knee of some cracker, Even the most addicted to white black person has some kind of visceral response to seeing that happen. And it's at those critical moments, it's almost like perhaps you've heard the term of the intervention, where family members will get together and call in a professional to do a so-called intervention to get that drug addicted person to go immediately to a rehab center. Similarly, we can also perfect the technique of motivating a person who is currently in the throes, in the grip of their white addiction, to perhaps at least give us a chance to help them out of it, at least give us a chance to help them detoxify from it. And you don't know until you try. And a right. part of our addiction, and once again, and value number five, is that, believe it or not, for a lot of people who have given up on and masses of black people, it makes them feel good to say, look at that Negro over there. Based on value number five, that the only way I can feel good about myself is by putting down somebody else. So I'm saying if we can overcome that, take that scale off our eyes, we may see more potential soldiers than we've ever saw right. before. It's just as sticking with this whole scriptural theme, there was a point in the Bible in which Elijah started complaining to God that he was the only one who had kept the precepts of his religion. Nobody else around, and he was so weary of battling and trying to persuade people. And finally, God said, okay, look, I'm going to give you some rest. So he picked him up and put him under a shady tree and caused him to sleep for a while, to rest. And then when he woke up, he gave him a vision of thousands and thousands of other people just like him that he was unable to either get to or to even believe that they existed. So I think when we approach it without that value number five hampering us, we may see that there are enough people out there that can be converted, that can be brought into detox, so to speak, enough to form the kind of army that we will need in order to fight back. So I'm just saying, don't get so stuck on our people seemingly being so obstinate and so deep into their addiction that we miss the opportunity to convert those who are actually convertible.
Right. Now, I heard you what you talked about, like in five. But that's based on false humility when we basically think that we are, you know, when we're in a place that we think we can just down other people. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about actual disrespect, and knowing who I am, what I'm capable of. And I have helped a lot of people on mm-hmm. different levels. But the mm-hmm. same thing, you know, at the same point, we got to deal with what's real out here.
And that's true. And let me just say this, though. That while we have to recognize, too, at what stage in the struggle we have arrived at. And that at this current stage, I don't think we have the luxury to dismiss too many people. Until we have gathered that critical mass of people that we need in order to be effective in our war against these white supremacists, we have to be open to almost anybody somehow proving that they can overcome their addiction to white. Certainly, if we were in a different stage, or at a different stage in our struggle, if we had already gathered that critical mass of people, that's the time to be extremely intolerant of anybody else that would anybody else among us that would oppose us, because then we really don't have the luxury of being very patient with them, because we're just about ready to march on to or debouch onto the battlefield. So I don't have time for your treacherous affair with white folk. At that point, if you are an acolyte of our oppressor, of the white oppressor, then we will have to treat you as if you were white.
Thank
In other words, you have become a functional honky. And now that we are ready to, I know that's an old term, but anyway, as long as at this point, of having gathered the requisite people, we are ready to make our move. So we're no longer really looking to convert anybody else. If somebody comes to join up with the army who are already ready, that's fine too. But we're past the stage of building the army, I guess is what I'm saying. But until we get to that stage, we have to be open to any and everybody. And I'm not saying that you spend a whole lot of time. Some people, it is very clear that they are hopeless and completely lost. So, as I said previously, with a tear in my eye, or in our eyes, we can therefore decide to move on until we gather the critical mass, and those people will be consumed by us as we march against the enemy, because those people have become the enemy. But until we reach that point, I don't think we have too much of a choice to be, but to be open to everyone until they absolutely prove, and they basically will remove themselves from our presence because they're so addicted to white. We don't have to do that for them. And then we move on until we gather enough people who think alike.
Okay, I got you, Dr. Fox. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your feedback, and I'll continue listening.
Thank you.
Okay, good.
Thanks for your call, Brother Brown.
And thank you for reading the book and getting it.
Yes, sir.
Let's go to another 267-267-296. Are you there? 267-296.
Hello? Yes, yeah. Good afternoon, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir? Can you get to, because it's like an echo. I don't know whether you have something up
on the speakerphone or something.
Are you there?
Hello. Hello.
Yes. Repeat. Yeah. You are you on the speakerphone?
No, I'm not. No.
Yeah, it's a loud echo. Oh boy. And I know you're calling from a distance. Let's try to fight through it and see what happens.
All right, I'll tell you what I do. I'll ring back.
Okay, thank you, sir. Let's try that again. 267-296. Are you there? Let's put them on hold. Maybe they stepped away. Let's go to 414. 414.
Good evening.
Yes.
Hey, Brother Elliot. Hey, Brother Richard.
Hey,
Dr. Fox. I want to first thank the Time for an Awakening family for all your wishes, prayers, meditations, and concerns. I'm at home. I'll be doing my program tomorrow.
You broke up. Are you still there?
What you're talking about tonight fits very well in to what Marcus Garvey was all about. You're talking about having the mindset to think totally independent, because we're up against a people who have no regard for our lives and who has manipulated our mind to make us have no regard for our lives as well. So this is a very good conversation. And although to me, European, and this is what I call it, I'll call it white supremacy. In fact, Brother Paul was about to go on. He hit me to this. I call it European, Caucasian, extremism, racism, and privilege. Because there's no such thing as race. There's no such thing as race. Europeans devised the concept of race, giving everybody a classification and a categorical classification with us at the bottom of that classification. That is why globally, to be melanated, be dark-skinned, you are despised. I don't care what the culture is across the globe. You are despised. You're at the low rung, you know.
And yeah, so, I say that in the book, by the way.
Mm-hmm. You do? Yeah, yes. That's important.
Yeah, get the book and read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I got the book.
You do? Good.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. I got the book. Because you were on a couple of years ago, and I got the book. Mm-hmm. And I think it's vitally important that we understand that we are addicted to white in service to the oppressor, you know, and that we will, some of us will do whatever it takes to please the oppressor.
Yeah, but you know, it's equally important that we understand that it's not hopeless. That just as we have become addicted to white, we can enter together, helping each other. We can enter and maintain recovery. And that's where our emphasis has to be placed, because otherwise, if the situation really is hopeless, then we just need to pack up and just pursue our own little individual goals and be through with it, you know?
Yeah, but see, you know, what individualism is a European or Caucasian desire.
Exactly.
You know, but collectivism is an African imperative. It is a must, because we are a collective people. We did not do what we did, you know, individually. We did it collectively. We did not build the great societies that we did individually. We did them collectively. And so, you know, I maintain that the worldwide African liberation movement, you know, as Marcus Garvey envisioned, must take place, and it must take place now.
Right, but the only way that we can accomplish our permanent liberation is if we first free our minds. Just as the In Vogue song goes, free your mind and the rest will follow. And that is a very true principle. So we have to get busy helping ourselves and each other free our minds so that we can see more clearly what our potential, number one, and how we can use that potential to free ourselves and not be dependent upon someone else, like a politician, to feed us what we need. Yeah.
Well, you know, I like the funkadelic free your mind, you know, free your mind and your ass will follow. But I love In Vogue because there's some beautiful sisters. But I know I agree with you. And the fact is, I use the analogy that the European has put a vice grip on our mind. And when you understand the tool of a vice grip, once it is set, it is very difficult to just pull it apart. Not even the strongest man can pull it apart. But there's a knob at the end of the handle. The knob at the end of the handle is symbolically acquiring knowledge of self. And the more knowledge you get of yourself and confidence, you begin to turn that knob and it begins to loosen that vice grip until finally you see the European for who and what he is. And not that you challenge them, because there's nothing we could do about that. They suffer from cognitive dissonance. They believe that they're superior. Everything in their environment they created for themselves says to that they're superior. And so even though you have a plethora of information to prove otherwise, they dismiss it, they ignore it. But see, but not only do they suffer from cognitive dissonance, they suffer from Caucasian fragility. They are fragile. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. If you get the documentary Holy Hierarchy, a psychologist, Robin DiAngelo, is in the piece, and she's the one who coined the phrase Caucasian fragility or white fragility, because it was coming out of the Trayvon Martin and all the things that were happening, and she was giving workshops to Caucasians, and she noticed that they didn't want to hear that from her.
Right, but here again, and we get really bogged down and to constantly describing the problem without any real focus on how we overcome. And in too many cases, when you listen to how we describe a problem, implicit in our description is the idea that we can't do anything about it. So we spend all of our time describing the problem over and over and over again in a million different ways without ever saying, okay, here's the problem, but here is what we can do about it. And in some ways, I think that the fear, something that Brother Richard mentioned earlier, which I didn't get a chance to get into more deeply, but the fear of what it will take to overthrow our enemy causes us to subconsciously, I believe, not want to engage in war. Because, you know, it's a human nature to think about at least self-preservation. And as I describe in the book, basically it's human nature to become very cowardly and to think about only your physical continuance or your physical survival and not your spiritual and mental survival. And to be willing to exchange, as I explain also later on in the book, to exchange your spiritual and mental survival, i.e. your dignity, your self-respect, for simple physical survival. But that all can be addressed if we come together in the type of group that I prescribe in the book in order to thrash these things out and thereby gain more trust in each other, our willingness to unify with each other, and more courage to do the things that are required in order for us to procure permanently our liberation. But just going over and over and over again about we're sick in this way and we're sick in that way and our enemies are sick in this way and they're sick in that way, that's not getting us anywhere. We've been doing that for 400 years.
Brother Oshie, hold on, brother, please. We also must understand that there hasn't truly been an honest critique of the problem that we face and how we can overcome them.
That's part of describing the problem accurately. And right. I think in the book I do describe it very accurately. So once we got an accurate description of what's blocking us, then we have to take that description and see whether or not there is a solution to that problem, that very specific problem. And then if there is, then apply all of our energy and all of our talk and all of our mind to indeed solving the problem.
Exactly, and that is our mind.
Hey, thanks for your
call. Well, no, that's not the solution.
Controlling our mind.
Thanks for your call.
Right. Controlling our mind is the solution. And just saying that it's not going to happen, we have to develop a protocol. Now, I have developed a protocol in the book for reclaiming our mind from the enemy. I'm not particularly saying that that's the only protocol. Of course, I believe it is, but it may not be. But at some point, we have to engage that protocol in order to do just that, get back the control of our mind. We just can't say, because once again, it's masquerading as a solution, but it's not really a solution. It's a further description of the problem. Well, we have to control our minds. Well, that's a description of a problem. The solution is always how. And if you can't see in what a person is saying, if they're not describing how, then they're not describing a solution. They're just describing another problem masquerading as a solution. So it's how. Step one, step two, step three, tell me how.
You know, I didn't want to keep you over time, but you still got a little while to stay with us, Dr. Fox?
Yes.
Good. Mm-hmm. And I just want callers to maybe kind of shorten it up, ask a question or two. I don't want to limit the folks' contributions, because I never really do that. I kind of let people talk, but for the sake of time tonight, we're going to kind of move it ahead a little bit. Let's go back again to caller. Are you there?
Yeah, I am here, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm absolutely fantastic. And how are you?
Great. I'm doing great.
Good. Good afternoon to all the callers. It's a great thing to hear Brother OG's voice, and it's absolutely brilliant to hear Dr. Jerome Fox. I know you're short of time, so I'm going to pose the questions very quickly. Firstly, it's elating, it's ecstatic to hear Dr. Jerome Fox talk about and make the admission that great deal of us have adopted cowardice, in adopting cowardice, we tend to not want to really talk about the solution and come to the realization that many of us are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
if we are to overtake this. Now, I'm born in this country, UK, London, England, and one thing I can say about these English people, which I'm born amongst, one thing they know how to do is fight. I can tell you that. Have no reserves about that. Anywhere they go in Europe, they fight. They're well known for fighting. So I can't really see how we are going to take back what belongs to us without a fight. And I think anybody who believes it's going to be any different is delusional. But anyway, I'd like to ask Dr. Jerome Fox. I know his book is probably written for those who identify themselves as African American.
No, it's written for the entire black world. So I know that you can get the book in London, where you're at. So ask for it and get it. It's written for all black people. But go ahead.
Okay. The question I'd like to ask you then is, you know, this language we speak, which is called English, which belongs to the white people, it's their language. And I'm just wondering that how far does the language contribute to this addiction? And by the title African American, seems to suggest that American language. I'm just assuming it's English. But the bottom line is the African, without being able to speak an African language, how do you overcome an addiction which has been forced upon you, i.e. the language English?
Well, I think it is true, and I'm not a total expert in linguistics, but I think it is true that language helps to shape your worldview. And that, to a certain degree, your worldview, and another way of phrasing it, is that and to a certain degree, your worldview is shaped by the language you use to describe it. So I acknowledge that. But like most things that we are confronted with, we have to do the best with what we have. And just luckily, And certainly this is my belief. We can use the tools that we have available to us to no fault of our own, the limited range of tools that we have available to us to begin the process of liberation. And the English language does not prevent us from taking a look at like the five white values that I described in my workbook and seeing if indeed our behavior reflects these values, white values. And then in turn, taking steps to detoxify ourselves of these values. And we and as we do that, as we enter and maintain recovery, a lot of things will become clearer and clearer to us. And one of those things may be that all of us has to study our native tongue. But to get us to that point, we have to begin where we're at. And we can do that.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that, but I just want to put it out there that it's important that we realize, because we talk about the mind and the solution for the mind. Well, obviously, I'm not an expert in linguistics, but I can quickly come to the conclusion that if you dream in English, they say the language you dream in becomes your mother's tongue. And unfortunately, when your language has been stolen and you can only dream in English, then I think it's a problem, because it affects the way your mind thinks, limits your imagination. It condones you to think like a European.
Yeah, but I would only say in response to that once again, that with that constraint, within that constraint rather, there is significant latitude to still move forward in our quest for liberation. If you listen to the words of people like Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, and many many others, they spoke in English, and yet their words were ascendant to in many ways. Ascendant in the sense that we could be lifted on their lyricism, on their words, to reshape our perspective. And people who heard them speak were almost like slayed in the spirit, so to speak, with those same English words from the same recordings that Elliot played during the about 10-minute intermission. You are lifted by those words to think differently and throw off the shackles that bind you. So we can't, we have to always be about the truth, no matter what the truth is. And the truth is that you can be lifted with whatever language really you speak, at least enough to the point, at least enough to be brought to the point whereby you can further refine your liberation by, as I said earlier, perhaps reconnecting with your native tongue and other aspects of your native culture. But while on the way, you have to use the vehicle that is available to you. And their examples, the Malcolm X's and others, their examples prove in truth that you can use your situation, whatever language you've been handed, to lift yourself to the point where you even realize, become to realize that there's more than just the English perspective or language.
Paul,
thank you for your thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for your contribution.
Thank you.
Let's go to 215. 215.
Good evening.
Yes.
How are you doing?
How are you, sir?
Doctor, I'm doing very, very well. Doctor, Brother Elliot and Doctor, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. My question is extinction. The dictionary describes extinction in two ways. One is when the final organism has died, and second is when a organism's ability to reproduce falls below its death rate. Now, if you look at the research, that has already happened in for Caucasians around the world. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think the whites are very sensitive, particularly these days, to their low birth rate. And I mentioned that in the book as well. That's why they are enlisting the help of the Pope and everybody else to try to sort of stave off what is actually happening in the world, which is melanated people becoming so populous that we really just by dint of our numbers take over. So yeah, I think they are very much aware of that, and that's why maintaining a foothold in your head is so important to them. That's why they don't want you to stop worshiping them, to stop thinking that it's a privilege to be on the ticket of a presidential administration without any clear vision of how you're going to use that that seat at their table to gather all the goodies that your community needs and bring it back to them, but instead start talking about how you serve everybody and not just simply your the people that you sent there. So they become very, very much interested in convincing you that you have an inescapable dependence upon them, that you need them in order to live the so-called good life. Once again, that good life as they have defined it, not as you have used your agency to define it. So that's why they have developed such an intricate system to keep you mentally bound. But yes, go ahead. And let me just say, I'm sorry, because through that method, they don't need to have the same numbers because they have gathered enough robots that will act at their behest and on their behalf. That in truth, it may look like, let's just say there's 500 white people and 1,000 black people, but in truth, when you look at their control of the black people, there's really functionally more like 1,000 white folk, because as they taken over the mind of 500 from our ranks. If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. And that's the only way you can really stay in control is to have control of other people.
That's right.
Now, there was a coin, there was a term coined by a professor, a psychologist named Bradford Cannon, and it was called the flight or fight response.
Mm-hmm.
How is this underlying feeling of extinction related to police officers shooting black people, people attacking black people, and how's that related to the fight or flight response?
I think that whites have been putting up a fight ever since they a more intense fight, I should say,
ever since they realized that their numbers were dwindling. So that is a part of the fight or flight syndrome. They're not fleeing; they're fighting. And as I just said, that part of their fight to stay and to maintain their status quo, their white supremacist status quo, is to use whatever weapons at their disposal. To limit the people that they fear or may take over if they were just left to their own natural instincts.
Excellent answer. My last question is this, and I'm particularly interested in your opinion. The best way to respond to the statistical justification. This is a common statement that a lot of debaters make. There are 90% of murders committed by black males, and that justifies the brutality of police. How would you best respond to that?
Well, first of all, I really, at this juncture, I don't even try to respond to that because I know the trap that they're trying to set in that discussion. But the truth of the matter is, if a person chooses to respond to it, is that what they fail to realize, as a matter of fact, I think I have a very good phrase in the book. I always try to stay anchored to the book that responds to that. One of the thoughts for the day. I think it's thought number, let me see if I can get to that page real quick. When I talk about slave, when I define slave, it's a very long definition, so I'll try to abort it. And I talk about those blacks who become functional whites. And even the black gangbanger, he's serving the function of white folk to kill black people. The white person doesn't have to enter our hood to kill us. He has shaped the mind of the black person to kill his own. But I say at the same time, while we identify that the the black functional white KKK hate on that snarky whites. Our snarky white racists are quick to highlight these white value dependent black folk who do the same thing to other blacks that the white racists are accused of doing to us. But not surprisingly, the same white racists are slow to remember that these addicted lily-livered surrogates, i.e. slaves, have been forged by unrelenting white oppression for the specific purpose of extending the white oppressors' reach into and control over black communities. So the violence that you witness in our communities, it's nothing more than an instance of that reach of the white oppressors' impact on in our community through controlling the minds and distorting the minds of that gangbanger who has no respect for his own life and therefore has no respect for any life that looks like him or her. So really, it's nothing, but still it falls at the feet of our white oppressors. Now, they want to deny that, of course, but I don't care about their denial. The truth, they are allergic to the truth. I don't want us to be allergic. And by the way, I'm not saying
because you can construe the white, rather the black gangbanger's behavior as nothing more than being a being controlled remotely through shame and self-hatred by our white oppressor. I'm not saying, though, that that at some point, if we were organized to do so, we should not make that gangbanger accountable for his behavior. Because if, after trying to explain the origins of his behavior and giving him other options, he still chooses to do the bidding of our white enemies, then we have to treat him just as we would treat our white enemies, and that is exterminate him as well.
That was an excellent answer. It's an excellent paradigm shift. It's a different way of thinking. I often, with my students, I have them go back on YouTube and pull up the dramatic scene from Roots where Kunta Kinte is being whipped and whipped into submission. They say his name is Toby. And I say, look at the person who is whipping Kunta. And they are, to a student, shocked to see that it is a black man who was holding the whip.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are totally.
Now, I would only say, though, that we see that, and our tendency is to berate that black person, just as we berate people like, let's say, Michael Jordan or Michael Jackson, the late Michael Jackson. But all I'm saying is that all of those people were forced to adopt that posture. And we got to give them a chance to rethink that and an opportunity to rethink that, which they did not have, or that person did not have at the time. And after giving them an opportunity to rethink or repent, which means rethink, think again, about their behavior and the condition of their mind, which they are not responsible for putting themselves in that condition, but have to accept responsibility for getting themselves out of that condition. And if they refuse to do the hard work that it takes to, once again, enter and maintain recovery, or in other words, throw off those shackles, then they qualify for our ire and our effort to dismiss them in the same way that we would dismiss any white person trying to kill us.
Excellent. Doctor, it was a pleasure talking to you. Brother Elliot, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for your contribution.
I'm going to have to go. My alarm is going off because I have to do something.
I know it. I know it. We kept you overtime, and I'm sorry for some of the calls. It didn't get a chance.
No, that's fine. I enjoy
to speak.
It. Mm-hmm. We didn't get to my analysis of why we are so overjoyed by Senator Harris's selection by a white boy to be her, to be his running mate, but maybe at some later time.
Yeah, I got to get you back, because I want to also talk about some of the solutions that you talk about this violence, this plague
right.
of violence in our neighborhoods. I think some
right.
of the things that you mentioned in the book is excellent things to put out here as solutions. But we'll talk soon. I'll get you back on. Thank you for being with us, Doctor. You can give out the information of how people can get the book.
Yeah, the book is available at Hakeem's there, what is 52nd and Walnut, and any bookstore you can ask for it. But the quickest way is to order it from Amazon.com.
Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Bye now.
Take care.
Richard, interesting conversation. And listen, we're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, I'm going to spend about 10 more minutes, Richard. I want to share something with you.
Okay.
We'll do that. Again, I'm going to apologize to some of the callers. Didn't get a chance to talk to Dr. Fox because some of our callers was a little bit lengthy, but it was a lot of good information shared. And just stick with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. IBBToMe.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global KometsU Black family, to join your interconnected KometsU Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
Know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. The brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of Black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the Black agenda. Thank you.
We have a message to the black man. Because the black man today is a man who has been made now almost into a laughing stock. Nobody takes the black man serious. We're just used to be somebody's tool. We are the sportsmen. We're the singers and the dancers. And we're also labeled as the pimps and the criminals and the drug dealers and the killers and the vagabonds of society. We're the bogeymen of British society and other Western systems. And we want to dispel that lie and destroy those myths and put the black man back on the map where we belong. Who is the black man? The black man is the original man. If it wasn't for the black man, no other men could be on this planet. We are the fathers of humanity. We gave birth to all of you.
We are the watchmen on the wall. You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchmen for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is the people vote, but they don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend?
You can't do nothing for me. See, that's what we got to be careful of. We got to be careful of who we bow down to. But see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us.
Yeah.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back. Excuse me. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 9:38 here in the city of Philadelphia. I want to thank again our guest that was with us this evening, author and psychologist Dr. Jerome Fox. The book, Addicted to White, The Oppressed in League with the Oppressor, a Shame-Based Alliance. And again, you can get that book at several different locations. Ordered Amazon and here locally, Hakeem's, which is a black bookstore up here in Philadelphia on 52nd Street. Richard, it was interesting conversation. I wanted to get to a couple other things with Dr. Fox, but the time flies by so quickly. It's going to be an interesting conversation getting him back. You know, I like what he said in reference to trying to reach our people and the things that we can say to them in the language that we use to try to convince them that we all need help. You know, it's similar to on the collage there. If you remember, Khalid Muhammad is on one of the collages. A lot of the people now that are on those collages that I play are ancestors.
Right.
And he said, if you remember, Richard, he said, I'm a slave.
Right.
And he said, you're a slave. And he said, unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. That's right. That's similar, almost exactly to what Dr. Fox is saying.
Right.
All of us have this addiction to one form or another, and we got to try to help one another.
Right.
That's it. Accepting it.
And I mean, listen, that's what we try to do on this program, and then put out information where the people can hear it and make their own decisions on what's being said. A lot of these people, and to show that addiction, Richard.
Right.
And it's easy to show it with politicians. White folks, when they're talking to one another or talking about you, the language is different. The approach is totally different. I want to give people an example of what I'm talking about. Now, I don't have to use, because to me, Democrats and Republicans is the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a good cop, bad cop type of relationship that they use to fool the people, especially our folks. But so I'm not playing any clips by any Republicans. We all know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Let me play. I want to play just a few brief clips here. Listen to the language and what is stated by Biden and his new running mate, Kamala Harris, in reference to, and I'm going to pick two subjects. He's addressing a European audience, Europeans that's at AIPAC convention. I ain't dealing with the religious part of it because they're Jewish, but they're Europeans. Both of them, I got clips of both of them talking to AIPAC and then talking to you and about you. Listen to the language and what they're saying. First, I'll play Biden, and then I'll play Harris, if I can get this stuff up here quickly, Richard. And I want you to hear it also.
Could the U.S. also compensate descendants of enslaved people? Do you support reparations for African?
Wait a minute. I don't want to start there. That would be the second one. Let me start with this one first.
What impresses me most is what I know those of you who've been with AIPAC a long while understand is the lifeblood and the certainty and security. And that is the more than 4,000 young people you have here. Would all the young people who are here stand up if it's your first? I want to see you. It's really, really, really important. From teenagers to college kids making an early and enduring promise, I want to thank you for being here. When we talk about the relationship between our two great nations and how to deepen it, it's a generational issue. Generation after generation is the building block upon which we guarantee the success of our endeavor. Whether or not dynamic change in the Middle East or relationships open up between Israel and its neighbors, one thing is certain. The United States will constantly and forever have Israel's back. But I mean this sincerely. No administration has done more to advance the security of Israel than we have. Our unprecedented security opposition cooperation makes me incredibly proud. And our commitment to Israel's qualitative military edge is unquestionable, will not change. And we will make sure that Israel has the best equipment available. When we deliver F-35 jets later this year, Israel will be the only nation in the Middle East with fifth-generation aircraft. Continue to ensure that Israel is represented on critical committees just like other nations. And we will continue to push back against the calls here in the United States for people to boycott, disinvest, or sanction Israel.
Now, Richard.
Yeah.
Now, in that particular clip, he was addressing AIPAC.
Right.
And if you notice, it wasn't rhetoric that he was saying to them. He was talking about substantive policies that they put in place in reference to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Not pie in the sky, not something I'll do that you never see. He was talking about substantive pie. He told those, wherever they were, some forum where they was a stadium or wherever, a coliseum where they was talking at, it was over 4,000 young whites, Jewish, there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what we've done for you is generational. You heard him say that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's policies there, substantive policies that have already been put in place, he said, by his administration. That clip came from 2016, just when him and Obama was leaving. So he talked about what their administration, Obama, did for Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started talking about the other policies, militarily support. They're always going to be there, sending them fifth-generation aircrafts and weaponry. Then at the end, he talked about they're going to do everything they can to fight against this BDS movement here in the United States. You heard him say it.
Mm-hmm.
Three things that didn't deal with rhetoric, because you can look back now and see that all of those things, including that BDS legislation, is put into place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's look at what he states, and it's only brief. Let's look at what he states to something dealing specifically with black folks. He was asked a question. Now, let's listen to this.
Could the U.S. also compensate descendants of enslaved people? Do you support reparations for African Americans? Vice President Biden, do you support reparations?
Look, I mean, since I haven't spoken on this, got a chance. Number one, the reason we're the country we are is because of immigration. We've been able to cherry pick the best from every single continent. The people who come here have determination, resilience. They are ready to stand up and work like the devil. We have 24 out of 100 children in our school today is Hispanic. The idea that we are going to walk away and not provide every opportunity for them is not only stupid and immoral, but it's bad for America. They are the future of America, and we should invest in them. Everybody will benefit from it, every single American. And you should get used to it. This is a nation of immigrants. That's who we are. That's why we're who we are. That's what makes us different, and we should invest in it.
Now, Richard,
Now,
am I in a Twilight Zone? Was he asked a question about
reparations? He answered the question at all.
But was he asked a question about reparations for African Americans?
Right.
He started talking about immigrants and Hispanics. And what? Come on here. Are people going to accept this stuff from these people just because they want one plantation owner out and substitute him for another? You going to accept this type of rhetoric from these people? He didn't even answer the question. Either this man got Alzheimer's or he's stupid. He's going to say something about somebody else being stupid in that clip. He was asked a specific question. He didn't even answer it dealing with African Americans. He talked about somebody being an immigrant. What does that have to do with descendants of our ancestors who was abused by Europeans? What does that have to do with Hispanics? What is he talking about? I just played those two clips for people to consider when they're running around, ringing on doorbells, talking about vote for Biden or Kamala Harris. I ain't got no, whatever these people do, they're going to do. All I'm saying is listen to the language, listen to what they're saying, and don't be lemmings. Don't be sheep. Don't be addicted to white or their white surrogates. Now, here we go. Let me play Harris. Her comments to AIPAC or Jewish organizations, it wasn't AIPAC. And then her addressing reparations, just like her running mate. Let me play her to Israel.
Hi, everyone. I'm so sorry I cannot be with you in person today at the AJC Global Forum. But as a member of both the Senate Intelligence Committee and the Senate Homeland Security Committee, I am deeply involved in ensuring the American-Israeli relationship remains strong. And I am proud to stand strongly with America's most important allies. So let me be clear about what I believe. Israel is a critical friend and ally to the United States. I stand with Israel both because of our shared values, which are so fundamental to the founding of both our nations, and I believe the bonds between the people of the United States and the people of Israel are unbreakable, and we can never let anyone drive a wedge between us. And I believe Israel should never be a partisan issue. I will do everything in my power to ensure broad and bipartisan support for Israel's security and right to self-defense. That is why I strongly support America's security assistance to Israel, and I am committed to strengthen the American-Israeli security and defense relationship. I believe that when any organization delegitimizes Israel, we must stand up and speak out against it. Israel must be treated equally, and that is why the first resolution I co-sponsored as a United States senator was to combat anti-Israeli bias at the United Nations and affirm and reaffirm that the United States seeks a just, secure, and sustainable two-state
solution. Bridget.
Yeah.
Now, you hear what she mentioned. Mm-hmm. Policies that she's done. And she sits on two committees, the Intelligence Committee and the Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. And said that basically letting them know that you have a friend in these areas. I'm going to do all I can, legislative-wise and otherwise, to help. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what she said in reference to reparations. Now, she didn't give an Alzheimer's answer like Biden, but she gave a runaround answer like a white politician or a white surrogate. Listen to her response about reparations.
Do you support reparations for black people?
Well, listen, again, we had over 200 years of slavery. We had Jim Crow for almost a century. We had legalized discrimination, segregation, and now we have segregation and discrimination that is not legal but still exists and is a barrier to progress. We have disparities around housing. We have disparities around education. We have disparities around income. And we have to recognize that everybody did not start out on an equal footing in this country. And in particular, black people have not. And so we have got to recognize that and do something about that and give folks a lift up. That's why, for example, I'm proposing the LIFT Act. Give people who are making $100,000 or less as a family a tax credit, which will benefit and uplift 60% of black families who are in poverty.
So by default, it affects black families, but there's not a particular policy for African Americans that you would explore.
Listen, the reality also is this. Any policy that will benefit black people will benefit all of society. Let's be clear about that. Let's really be clear about that. So I'm not going to sit here and say I'm going to do something that's only going to benefit black people. No, because whatever benefits that black family will benefit that community and society as a whole and the country. Right?
Right? Right, Richard? Right? It's going to be, listen, that Republican George Bush philosophy, Ronald Reagan philosophy about a rising tide floats all boats. Mm-hmm. Obama used the same philosophy. The rising tide will float European boats, but it only caused black folks to sink, to drown. So that was her. The girl, listen, the young lady was intelligent enough to know that she got a runaround answer from that woman. So she turned around and asked her again. Mm-hmm. And then it was a lot of stumbling and stammering. I didn't hear any stumbling and stammering when she addressed the Jewish organization.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear. Her words were strong. I heard a lot of he was stumbling, stammering, and well, wait a minute. After she asked the question the second time, she basically said, "I'm not doing anything specifically for black people."
Mm-hmm.
So all we got to do, people, pay attention to the language. We don't have to get into the name calling. Oh, she got a white husband. Oh, she's not. She's got an Indian mother. I don't care about all that foolishness. These people don't represent you or your interests. They don't. That's clear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just want to share that. If you want to make some comments on it, Richard, that's cool. But I just want to share those two clips.
See, after our conversation with Dr. Fox, it's kind of really difficult to address how we those things are not that position is not it's not new, right? So it's what and it's just interesting that it just a continuous reflection. And I'm using this word of our powerlessness, and I want to use in the context of Dr. Fox, and I believe it has to be both. You know, when we talk about power, he says it has to be inner psychic, right? But I also believe that it has to be social, and that's what we and I even don't even like to use the Jewish example because it's so blatant, right? That is inner psychic. Jews are Jews, and they'll let you know they're Jew, but they also are social. Obviously, they have something to make to where they can get that kind of influence from the U.S. government, right? For the state, where Black people can get that kind of, as you're saying, that kind of, and that's because of our powerlessness. And
wait a minute, Richard. I might not necessarily agree. It's powerlessness,
mm-hmm.
because we got power if we start adopting some of those. Start withdrawing ourselves from this system,
and it'll
fall. This place will fall like a deck of cards if Black folks. Go ahead.
And that's why I'm trying to frame this. If we're not healthy, we can't. And that's what I heard Dr. Fox dealing with. We can't get to this action steps of solutions until we get the critical mass that produces the power that we're saying that so we could talk like we have the action step that we're at the action step part, but where we're at is in addressing that we have a health crisis that we're not addressing. We're defining the problem where we can either define the problem continuously or not define the problem and say that we have a solution to it. But you can't have a solution until you resolve the problem. And we're at, and what we keep getting feedback is that about that our problem hasn't been solved. And our problem is a power, internal power, relationship with ourselves as an individual and as a group to deal with our trauma and our fear. We haven't dealt with it. And until we do, we cannot deal with the external power relationship of how other people, interest groups or political machineries and I heard that term as far as the people who work in the Black people working in the interests of white people to do Black people harm. We can't do nothing to them until we deal with this here. And that's, and I'm saying if in that equation, in my mind, we might have potential power, but we do not have power. But that's my point of view in trying to address this. That perspective, because I can't see why we haven't over the 400 years we haven't. It's only been isolated groups, and we still seeing that it's been collaborators who even prevented them. When we look at the revolts, we look at the political prisoners. We're looking at people who are maintaining. Black people who are maintaining Black people being in an unhealthy condition.
Yeah, I agree.
And Carmella and the Democratic Party and the Blacks in the Democratic Party and the Black people saying vote you know, vote like your life depended on it, or because other people died. We have not addressed. All that is good, but as those clips show, you do that, and these people say, you're doing that, and we're telling you we ain't thinking about you.
Oh, boy. Listen, Richard, before we leave, you got 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Good. Let's get 646 in here with a few minutes that we got left. 646.
Hey, listen, I was just really enjoying the show until the end when you had to play those two sinister characters that got these black folks duped already. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing that this woman and him have both said the same thing, basically, that they don't give a damn about black folks, and they only gonna use them. And these crazy Negro kids, as I call them, are just basically acting like children at Christmas time, enjoying opening up their gifts. I mean, this is what it is, I guess. And that's why I really wanted to ask Fox, what is the end game in all of this? Because everything has an end game. And to me, I don't see the end game for black folks, man. It's like, it's getting kind of ridiculous. Because if Biden get in office, we screwed. If Trump stay in office, we screwed. And for some reason, we don't feel as though we screwed with Trump still in office and Biden in office. I mean, I think to me personally, Biden is probably more harmful because what he do is he'll just put the people to sleep. And when he has to leave, if he has to leave early, then you got somebody like Kamala Harris, who is basically Barack Obama 2.0 with a vagina. That's all. I mean, it's real. We in trouble. But we don't get it because we don't understand what our value is as a people and what our position is in this country and how we should be thinking about how we move forward as a collective, as a people. So whereby we settle for individuals whose job is not to approve upon the black community, but is to build the empire. I mean, the relationship between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden is basically the same with black folks. I mean, so what? She's an AKA. I mean, most of them chicks are nitwits anyway, so I mean, I don't care about that. But, I mean, if you look at her history and you look at her record, I mean, she doesn't have a glowing record in regards to how she done dealt with and addressed black people. But I guess because she's black, we happy.
Well, yeah, because most of the people are not looking at the record. Like you said, I heard people talking about, oh, she's a black Greek. She was from a black Greek organization. Oh, she's the first. Exactly. She'd be the first vice president. I mean, like you said, so what? Look at the policies that these people have pushed. Say that again.
The black Greeks don't have no African value. Your value system is based on some Greekology.
But see, if you.
But
see, that goes back to our guest, Dr. Fox. If you don't know who you are and is proud of your culture and your values, then you hold other things above the people. For example, if I'm a black Greek organization, I hold the Q's or the who, I don't know. Listen, I've never played in any of the organizations, so I don't know the names. I do know a Q. I'll hold the Q's ahead of me being black. If I'm a Christian, if I'm a Christian or a Muslim, I'm going to uphold Christianity or being a Muslim above being black.
Yeah.
Anything above being black, because that's secondary to me. I'm not proud of that. It's a psychological thing, just like we were just talking about with our guests.
Right.
And the undercurrent of this and how we're describing it, and I think going back and forth is this the value of individualism, whether it be by organization or by individuals. I don't believe that, you know, if you poll Black people right now, and all you say, Jay, is being true, Black people still will feel, and that would even be the ones who are strung out, the ones who are stressed out, and the ones who are working two jobs, the ones who, you know, are dealing with unknown, you know, just discrimination in where they work in order to get that, they will still say as an individual that they're doing better, that they're doing better than the next person, and they believe they will be doing better in the future. And because of that answer, that answer just comes out of an individual position, which Dr. Fox says is in a value that is tied to whiteness.
Right, but if you really put it into context, it's based upon your hatred for your Blackness and your unwillingness to collectively take your Blackness above whiteness.
But that's the same thing. I mean, it's just adding clothes to it, but it's saying the same thing. But it's not addressing the challenge that I'm having is that we have, and I know, Ellie, you say that, you know, the point, because I shouldn't use the word powerless, but we have no power to contain, control, and define and protect Black people at this present.
We can't put
no barrier around Black people and say there's no structure, none of the structures out there at this present can be able to say, you know, y'all ain't going out and tell white folks, media, military, marketing, commercial, communication, entertainment, y'all are not coming in. There is nothing we have. We can't even point to an institution or do that. And if we point to, well, you're the one that's supposed to be responsible, they'll say, I'm responsible to do for me, which goes to that individual value, as I say.
Yeah, but that's because unfortunately we haven't come together and built the institutions and been able to do the most important thing, protect them.
Well, and that's what he's saying, you know, it's because we say about Blackness, but we have not said that we are as a people. And I know there's others who have made it, psychologists that have been promoted, that we as a people and everybody enunciated that we are a mental health case. Now, we just heard they told us that most of you Black people are sick. Now, and then they tried to come off, well, we really didn't know y'all was that sick until the virus came.
But that's not in the minds of those who don't suffer from the pandemic, what they think and what they feel. Let's be clear about something. Anybody who thinks that Donald Trump handled this pandemic situation the right way and based on what he has done with vote for him shows what type of brainwashed fool that you are. Because, I mean, now let's be clear this. Would Hillary Clinton handle the situation a little better? Maybe for the simple fact that she believes more in science than this fool do. Because this fool, his whole belief is in the dollar. Which amazes me because he ain't really truly honest about the dollar. He's about manipulation, deceit, lying, and all of those other type things in association with the dollar. You can't really be about the dollar from a straight up business perspective and going bankrupt seven times or five or six times. You can't basically have every business that you've inherited. And I mean, to me, I always ask this question. How could you trust a man that went bankrupt with a casino? I mean, that to me is wild. That right there alone shows his business acumen. That right there shows that he doesn't understand business, no business, on a level that it cracked up to be, or the fact that he was robbing the business blind. That's just not the type of business under.
Wealthy and wind up in it, I mean, very wealthy, and go and wind, and not because the house betted against him or collude, you know, that he just, you know, was not a good gambler.
But you know, the truth also is nobody really knows what his wealth is.
Right. But
that's the funny thing. I mean, in all of this, to be honest with you, I blame the media for Donald. I blame stupid white people and the media for Donald Trump. Because the things that they have allowed him to get away with, I could never honestly imagine him getting away with that years ago. I don't know. Maybe the media now is more about money than it was about, you know, reporting the news. And then back then, also, remember, they had investigated reporting going on and all that. So maybe it would have been handled a little bit different. But as far as Donald Trump go, I blame the media and white folks. Black folks don't have a big enough of a position, nor do they have the intelligence to be blamed for it. And you're not gonna say to me that because we supposedly didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, that's the reason why he got into office. You play that game with somebody else. I know numbers, so I'm not even getting caught up in that. But the reality is, he said that he was going to build a wall. That was a lie. He said that he was going to show his taxes if he got in office, which was a lie. I mean, the man has basically lied, and at every turn there could be. But it seems like the media, in all honesty, has never held their foot to his throat in regard to his deception and lies. So that's why you have him at the point right now where you have the ignorant, the blind, and the stupid believing what he says when he's constantly manipulating, deceiving, and lying to you. That's the most mind-boggling thing as far as I go with him is concerned, because he's been able, if you think about it, to dupe a whole bunch of people to believe that he's a honest, straight-up truth teller. And I think the biggest thing that we need to look at this week is, how is the Congress and these so-called Democratic leaders that we have are going to deal with this post office thing? Because this post office thing is probably the most blatant form of manipulation, deception, deceiving that I've ever seen in my life, that is basically, so far it seems, they're going to be able to get away with it. I mean, it is absolutely mind-boggling. I can't see how this is even getting to the place where it's at right now in regards to things, let's say, been shut down. I mean, you know, this is crazy. I mean, people really need to look at it and really observe what's going on with the post office. It's incredible, man.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. So, I don't know. But listen, brothers, have a good week. Hopefully you'll come on this Friday, Elliot, and do your second job instead of drinking mimosas and eating
and all of
that other nonsense on a Friday night, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Brother Ricky, my Brother Richard, keep on doing what you're doing. Did I hear you earlier talk about you are now the head Zoom man in regards to all of the Zoom activities that you caught up?
Oh, no, no. Thanks.
You're a Zoomologist?
No, I ain't no head Zoom nothing. Matter of fact, I got a Zoom fear right now. And right. Brother Elliot is trying to get me to go to the next level.
Well, so, hey, Richard, you got the time, man. You can do it because it'll be an amazing thing if I hear a week or two or a couple of weeks from now, month or so, that Richard is a zoomologist. Anything you want to know about Zoom, call Richard.
Yeah, well, you might be surprised.
Have a good day, brother. All right.
Talk to you.
Don't put that out there, Ellie. I don't need no more work.
Before we leave tonight, let me give the lineup. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Ocean. I'm glad to have him back.
Yes.
Back on the battlefield. From 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, always interesting guests and conversations with Brother Ushi. That's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. From 6 to 8, Monday evening, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. From 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central with hosts Dr. Maria Kamban and Sister Nataki Kamban. That's 8 to 9. On Mondays on Time for an Awakening Media. From 9 to 10, the first and third Mondays of every month, Conversation Reparations. That's the first and third Mondays of every month. And no, not this week. So it won't be on tomorrow. On Tuesday, 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with your host, Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday after 7, with host Shani B. On Fridays, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Saturdays, Black Sister Talk from 4 to 6 on Saturdays, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers, and from 7 to 9, The Elders of Sankofa with host Alfonso Watkins. And then Sunday, Time for Awakening is back from 7 to 9, or 7 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of.
to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.